called War on Terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens is that no one before the body is called. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them. That is...
Insurgent Radio. Oh, well, White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker on a Freya's Day. Yeah, She-Wolf Day here in the bunker. And it's a beautiful day here in Indiana. The sun's shining and cooling off a little bit, but not much. Yeah. Don't forget, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And we're also at resist.com if you want a Harvard education in race, Aryan race separatism. Go up to resist.com. We've changed it quite a bit. And also with your felt pen, spread the word around the community. Resist.com. It's simple to do. Very simple to do. It's also simple to do this. Whenever you get an advertisement in the mail, or you find an advertised a prepaid advertising card around in a trash can or wherever you find it, pick them up. And all you have to do is take your felt pen and put the non-equal sign on it and slip it in the mail. You don't even have to have a manufactured decal like we've got them, you know. There's not enough people doing that. People want to say, well, what's going on with the racism? Well, what's racism doing and all that? Well, you don't advertise. It pays to advertise. And when I say lone wolf, I don't mean just hibernate in a corner someplace. You can get these prepaid postage paid envelopes and cards all over the place, and magazines. You go to the doctor, you can take them out of the magazines in the waiting room or the dentist, or dig them out of the trash cans and so forth. And if you just cannot get the gumptious up to take a felt pen and put a non-equal sign on and put them back in the mail, well, at least send them to me and I'll do it. Yeah. We got to advertise. And every time I get an advertisement in here with a postage paid card in it, I slap a decal on it or put the non-equal sign on it with a felt pen and put it out. They're going to think, there's none of those guys around, man. They're nowhere. And I know there's not enough of you out there doing it because nobody's complaining about it. Believe me, if there's enough of it being done, you know who's going to complain about it. So come on. Well, I got a nice letter here from a lone wolf. He says he's back in Lithuania right now. A few of us nationalists from England were here last March to join their freedom parade, celebrating when the country became independent after being under Soviet rule since 1944. We were greatly impressed by the demographics last year. We walked around the capital, Vilnius, and saw only two niggers the whole day, and that's too many. So far this year, we saw two at the airport before we even set foot outside. We got to our four-star hotel, and there was a bunch of ragheads in there. Yes, they smelled like curry. A short walk around the town, and we saw a Negro standing at the hotel entrance smoking. What are they doing here? My guess is the Lithuanian government has accepted a small quota, maybe a few thousand, and have spread them out at various hotels until they find them housing or send them back. We will have to see how the Freedom March goes here in Vilnius tomorrow. I'm thinking there is nowhere left to run. Lithuania is one of the few white countries left. But from what I've seen in the last 8 hours, they're going the same way as the rest of us. 14-5. That's not good news, baby. Not good news. Because just a few Negroes, and you know how they run after white women, can screw up the whole neighborhood and the whole community and the whole country in a very short time unless counteraction or a counter program is put in place. I know it's tough because the governments themselves back them up and guard them and send out soldiers and the police and everybody to stand guard over them. They love those little niggers. You know, what the main thing is, they're afraid of being called a racist like we are. We're not afraid to be called racist. I'm proud as hell to be called a racist. Well, I'm sure you may have seen a little bit of that debate last night. I could only take about 15 minutes of it. Number one, they weren't fighting, and that's boring. I don't want to watch anything where they're not fighting, calling each other names. Trump has tried to trump them by bringing on this Negro into his campaign. And how's that going to go over with all these right-wingers out there and David Duke and all those people? Donald Trump is bringing in the Negro Brigade. Oh, yeah. You know, what I'd like to know is whether at that top-level meeting in the Carolinas the other night of these top Republicans deciding what to do, whether they had a telephone patch to Trump and they talked it over with Trump, or did they smuggle him into the meeting or not. Something as big as going down, and like I say, I predict it was all set up way back. Trump is totally in on it, and and the big boys are in on it, and the only people that are not in on it are the people, the voters out there, who are too dumb to know any better. I see Trump saying we got to go far before waterboarding, got to go far beyond waterboarding in treating prisoners. Isn't that just ducky? And he said he wanted to send, 30,000 troops in there to fight ISIS? See, you can't win, guys. You can't win with these people. And to think that you can support one of them for a while, forget it. They're all bad. Bad, 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 bad. Well, let's see what that populist Jim Hightower has to say about war this morning.
War is hell. Unless, of course, you happen to be a global corporate peddler of rockets, drones, bombs, and all the other hellish weaponry of military conflict. In that case, war is literally manna from hell. So bring it on. Indeed, it seems as if Beelzebub himself is in charge these days, with U.S. military forces enmeshed in at least 135 countries in 2015 alone. Plus, such chicken hawks as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz maniacally are beating their flabby chests and screeching for even more military adventurism. This perpetual warmongering is music to the ears of the CEOs and big investors of the war machine, for it means a windfall of perpetual profits for them. In a rare admission of their war profiteering ethic, a group of major military contractors spoke late last year about how splendid war is. In tapes of speeches at a wealthy investors' conference, top weapon makers exulted about the spreading horror of ISIS and escalating wars in the Middle East and Africa, hailing the rising conflict in Syria and Turkey, for example. A Lockheed Martin honcho enchanted the potential investors with the happy news that Lockheed's profits would, quote, enjoy an intangible lift because of the dynamics of that war's environment and sales of our products in that theater. Raytheon CEO chimed in that his corporation was upbeat because of, quote, a significant uptick for defense solutions across the board in multiple countries in the Middle East. And all of these masters of war celebrated the joyous news that Congress had just delivered a $607 billion budget to the Pentagon, meaning more sales and more profit for war investors. "We think we did very well," exclaimed one. This is Jim Hightower saying, "Many go to war and die, but a few go to war and thrive. So see, it balances out." Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower.
And this from the National Memo Internet newspaper. It says, the National Memo's weekly update on the loony, bigoted, and hateful behavior of the increasingly unhinged right wing, starting with number 5. Okay, let's see what that is. We have a live one here. A man impersonating the former KKK leader David Duke filed a typo-plagued motion against Donald Trump in federal court, attempting to keep Trump from participating in the presidential race due to Trump being a danger to the American morals, values, systems, and principles, unquote. But moreover, would-be Duke says Trump must not be allowed to seek the highest office because Trump stole not Duke's intellectual property. And that intellectual property just happens to be a suite of extremist views. Fox Duke writes in his motion, quote, "Donald Trump stole my intellectual property and then claims he never knew me. He disavows me. I am the Republican who led the way in opposing affirmative action, massive immigration, and welfare exploitation. And Donald Trump stole my ideas while he disavows me. Donald Trump seems to feel he is entitled to steal people's ideas for his campaign and not give them credit, which is wrong, and I find that offensive." He continues. Now, this is a fake deal, supposedly, from Duke to this guy that filed this case in the courts. "After years of hard work I spent writing my book, My Awakening, about race and immigration, Trump thinks she can dupe European Americans and throw me under the bus. Now he's taking the credit for proposals I created to help make America great again. Donald Trump is a copyright infringer. He disavows me. But his fundamental ideas that I introduced into the party as a House of Representatives member, Donald Trump takes ideas and then disavows the people he borrows them from." The full motion is reproduced below, courtesy of Law News. You can go to LAWNEWZ, Law News, you can get all this stuff. The Duke imposter has created a nested doll of inanity here. He pretends to be one of our nation's most visible and local emissaries of hate, espouses the notion that somehow the very notion of white supremacy is a Duke original, wholly created and under the copyright of the ex-grand wizard, and then seeks damages from Trump for stealing said ideas, only to blast him for then disavowing them. Trump did, in fact, after much dithering, disavow Duke's endorsement of his campaign. But the Duke doppelganger does get one thing right. Donald Trump, quote, he writes, is a patent troll. The actual David Duke was not amused. Quote, "That's the biggest, dirtiest trick I've seen recently," unquote, he told the Tampa Bay Times. "They've really gone into the depths, the enemy. That would be a perfect smear. Even David Duke doesn't like Donald Trump," unquote. If you want to read more of this and the copy of the case, go up to lawnewz.com. Wow. Things are getting pretty hairy out there. Well, the ADL is doing us a favor again. They don't seem to understand it pays to advertise. The Anti-Defamation League decided to help these people know who all the racists are, providing Trump and other presidential candidates with a list of racist individuals and extremist groups who have inserted themselves into the presidential campaign. "We are providing information to all the campaigns to ensure that they steer clear of these extremists and others who promote anti-Jewism, racism, and white supremacy, said ADL CEO Jonathan A. Greenblatt. It is incumbent upon all candidates for office to reject and disavow any of these groups should they endorse or express support for their campaigns, unquote. The ADL said each individual on its list voiced support for a presidential candidate seeking higher office. That's the right wing. They keep trying to climb. They keep trying to climb onto it. Now, the ADL lists, and I won't go into the whole thing here, David Duke at the top, Kevin McDonald, William Johnson, Rachel Pendergrass. Let's see here. Louis Farrakhan. Wait a minute. White supremacist. Andrew Anglin. He runs a neo-Nazi website. Oh, yeah, that's Daily Stormer. Lee Rogers. Jared Taylor. Richard Spencer. Matthew Heimbach. Don Black. Wow. That's amazing. All of those guys are supporting one of the candidates, one or another. If they really liked the candidate, they couldn't think of a better way to screw them. In fact, that's, I guess, the best way to do it. If you don't like a candidate, you shouldn't like any of them. They're all assholes. Endorse them. Just come out in the press and endorse them, because the press will eat it up. The press will eat it up. Come out as your group and say, I'm supporting Rubio. I'm supporting Rubio. Well, the press will eat it up. Racists all over the country are supporting Rubio. And the press, they're so stupid they'll print it. Well, the Southern Millionaires Law Center reports the number of hate groups operating in the United States increased 14% from 2014 to 2015. Well, wait a minute. This is 2016. Hate groups increased from 784 groups in 2014 to 892 groups last year. When a group is two or more, maybe three or more. The number of anti-government patriot groups also grew by 14%, from 874 in 2014 to 998, man. Wow. It's great why, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center always writes this stuff up so they can suck the old ladies out of all their money, all the old Christian ladies. And Jews send us money because they're everywhere, man. There's hundreds of these groups around, and half of them are outside your house getting ready to firebomb you. I mean, talk about corrupt, rotten. I mean, these are supposed to be saviors of the people from these horrible, white supremacist anti-Jews. But they're, no matter how bad you say these groups are, the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ADL are worse, because they exaggerate the numbers of everybody just to take more money in. It's really unbelievable. But it's fine with me. Just spell the name right. I noticed my name wasn't on there. Well, that's okay. I'll forgive them for that.
Has 1,000 roots. It is a social cancer. The lie that is known to be a lie is half eradicated, but the lie that even intelligent persons regard as a sacred fact, the lie that has been inculcated around a mother's knee, is more dangerous to contend against than a creeping pestilence. Popular lies have ever been the most potent enemies of personal liberty. There is only one way to deal with them. Cut them out to the very core, just as cancers are. Exterminate them root and branch, or they will surely eat us all up. We must annihilate them, or they will us. half and half remedies are of no avail. However, when a lie has gone too far, when it has taken up its abode in the very tissues, bones, and brains of a people, then all remedies are useless. Even the lancet is of no avail. Repentance of past misdeeds cannot save decadence from extermination. The fatal bolt is shot, and into the fiery furnace of wholesale slavery and oblivion they must go, to be there righteously consumed. From their ashes something new, something nobler, may possibly evolve, but even that is the merest optimistic supposition. In nature, the wages of sin is always death. Nature does not love the wrongdoer, but endeavors in every possible way to destroy him. Her curse is on the brow of the meek and lowly. Her blessing is on the very hearts' blood of the strong and the brave. Only Jews and Christs and other degenerates think that rejuvenation can ever come through law and prayer. All the tears of all the martyrs might just as well have never been shed. 4. Whatsoever a people believeth shall... Chapter 3, The Spinning of the Web. Just as the spider weaves his silky web to lure flies into the larder of his banqueting hall in order that he may at his leisure pick the flesh off their bones, so deceitful ideals are cunningly woven by dexterous political spiders to capture and exploit swarms of human flies. What are the grandiose paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence but the weft and woof of a dazing spider web? And what are the American people but the flies that have been cleverly entangled in its gossamer meshes? For over a century, this declaration has been the parchment divinity of all public orators, from the curbstone dervish at the street corner to our elective monarch in the White House. Every 4th of July, Americans habitually scream themselves hoarse over its sounding generalities, making the welkin ring with tin horns, giant firecrackers, flag idolatry, brass bands, toy pistols, and heard bellowing generally. Although the great majority of them are mental and physical dwindlings, poverty-stricken and propertyless, yet how insanely they delight in amusing a sardonic world with their loquacious, flamboyant charlatanry. "We are sovereigns and equals," is their everlasting Barmecide chorus. Sovereigns and equals. In all lunatic asylums may be found inmates who fancy themselves kings and queens and lords of the earth. These sorrowful creatures, if only permitted to wear imaginary crowns and issue imaginary commands, are the most docile and harmless of all maniacs. As for the American people of today, is not their written constitution but a cunningly constructed straitjacket, their moral codes padded prison cells, their statute laws handcuffs and leg irons, their captains of industry keepers and turnkeys in clever disguise? 100 years ago, they ostensibly commenced independent operations with the richest continent on earth as their private property, their subscribed capital, and during the whole of that period, have they not been as busy as so many relays of draft beasts of burden, pumping the tremendous natural wealth out of their home soil and pouring it oversea into the cesspools of Europe? Is not that the work of lunatics? They smashed and splintered the wooden political yoke of an English king, and then proceeded to rivet around their necks a brand new yoke of bolted steel, which they forged especially to fit themselves and which they dignified under the name of constitutional freedom. Is not that also the work of lunatics? Cursed indeed are the harnessed ones. Cursed are they even though their harness be homemade, even though it tinkle musically with silver bells, aye, even though every buckle and link and rivet thereof is made of solid gold. How absurd of men to hurrah over their glorious political liberty, who have not even been able to retain possession of the substantial products of their own laboriousness. After a century of constitutional progress, 10% of the population are absolute owners of 92% of all the property. Now, O reader, are not these things the outward, invisible sign of organic dementia?
2. The Declaration of Independence commences by proclaiming an unto us falsehood, a black, degrading, self-evident lie, a lie which no one could possibly believe but a born fool. With insolent effrontery, it brazenly proclaims as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Rights which it thereupon proceeds to define in canting phraseology, imbecile and florid as it is false. Indeed, the mock-heroic preamble of this rhetorical pronunciamento is but a cunningly constructed piece of blague deliberately intended to deceive and betray. Indeed, the mock-heroic preamble of this rhetorical pronunciamento is but a cunningly constructed piece of blague deliberately intended to deceive and betray. It consists of a patchwork of plagiarized catchwords annexed wholesale from the ravings of 17th century levelers, crazed puritanic matoids, and 18th century cretinous French Jacobins, all mixed up and jumbled together with a long rigmarole of semi-meaningless pretty phrases culled mostly from an old-time melodrama. The Declaration of Independence has less real meaning for present conditions than a bottled-up Indian war whoop of the same period would have if uncorked now. It is a back number, musty, high-smelling, and worm-eaten, only fit for the walls of a museum or the brain cells of a daft philosopher. Its ethical and most of its political conclusions are shams, deceptions, and cold-blooded dishonesties, incandescent lies, glorified, belauded, printed in letters of gold, but nevertheless lies. Indeed, it has always been considered a piece of amusing mockery by those who really understood the secret intent for which it was originally constructed, viz., as a lasso for the bellowing herds that above 100 years ago were beginning to run wild and escape from their herdsmen and herdsmen's stock whip in this then boundless new world. To all contemporary demagogues, the high-sounding phraseology of the Declaration is as honey from paradise. Everywhere its seductive abstractions are the avatars of anarchism, communism, republicanism, and scores of other zymotic convulsionisms. Why then should sane men continue giving lip service to this subtle deception? Why should they, by their silence, acquiesce in the malefic efforts of organic weaklings? Instigated by prattlers of a false philosophy, to enforce by electioneering mass pressure an impossible and hideous equality ideal? Every national appeal is now made not to the noblest and the best, but to the riffraff, the slave hordes, who possess less intelligence than night owls. All that is brave, honorable, heroic is ignored tacitly for fear of offending the deified herd, the majority. Equality of conditions is its debasing shibboleth. And verily, he who has temerity enough to spit upon equality is liable to be horned to death. The voice of the people can only be compared to the fearsome shrieks of agony that may now and then be heard issuing forth from the barred windows of a roadside madhouse. The voice of God. Alas, alas. 3. There are two methods whereby masterful, ambitious men may hold any population in a state of ordered subjectivity. The first and by far the most honorable method is through an irresistible and highly trained standing army, ready to deploy anywhere with mechanical precision at a telegraphic nod in order to lay down the law at the cannon's mouth and sweep away all dangerous opposition. The second and cheaper method is, first of all, to inoculate those intended to be exploited with some poisonous political soporific, superstition, or theora. Something that, operating insidiously, hypodermically, may render them laborious, meek, and tractable. The latter plan has ever proved itself most effective because Aryan populations that would fight to the last gasp against undisguised military despotism may be induced to passively submit to any indignity or extortion if their brains are first carefully soaked in some abstract lie. At the period of the War of Independence, North America was far too wide, far too sparsely settled and far too poor in concentrated wealth to be effectively ruled and plundered upon the standing army principles either by King George or the successful junta of power-wielding revolutionists. Hamilton, Hancock, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Henry, and all the vested material interests that stood a solid phalanx behind these voluble patriots cast about for some safer method of ruling the minds of the uninformed but extremely valorous yeomanry, backwoodsmen, and mountaineers. After mature consideration, they determined to lull and lure the armed peasantry back again into a condition of blissful somnolence by instilling into their newly aroused minds false but seductive political idealisms, as subtle supplements to the fallacious and equally delusive but pre-existent religionisms and moralisms. This cunning plot worked like a charm, for equity of rights seems to puritanic minds the logical outcome of that other hoary old lie, equality before God. What a set of damned rascals they were, was Governor Morris's terse, rugged, but ever memorable description of the Congress of smart corruptionists that adopted and formally proclaimed those famous and fatal abstractions. Thereupon, the sword of power that conquered on the battlefield was carefully hidden away out of sight, and constitutionalism invoked to aid in the reharnessing of the conquerors of Cornwallis by their new masters. The old systems of jurisprudence and government, founded on naked force, were cleverly retained, even amplified, and at the same time the white-skinned populations were cunningly proclaimed free and equal. Never having enjoyed genuine personal freedom, except on the Indian border, being for the most part descendants of hunted-out European starvelings and fanatics, defeated battlers, they now stupidly thought that they had won freedom at last by the patent device of selecting a complete outfit of new tax gatherers every fourth year. 4. When we look back upon the childlike faith in constitutionalism displayed by our revolutionary fathers, together with their infantile republican specifics for the redemption of mankind, we cannot help smiling. At every general election since 1776, Americans have voted solidly for increasing the despotic authority of their elective rulers and taskmasters. Personal liberty is very nearly unknown, except in the newspaper. And any citizen who dares to think in direct opposition to the dogma of the majority does so at the risk of his life, if he thinks too loudly. Indeed, men of initiative and enterprise are now in the regular habit of purchasing immunity from communal molestation by bribing legislatures and officials upon a wholesale scale. The state is a blackmail agency. Enterprises necessitating state permits and large preliminary expenditures of capital cannot be safely undertaken until elective satraps, aldermen, judges, governors, congressmen, presidents, senators, etc., have first negotiated a percentage break-off. Neither life nor property is safe from the malignant revenge or greed of government officials or their confederates. He who would assert himself in this republic under present conditions must be a man of unscrupulous acumen and shrewdness. He must know the exact price of every patriot with whom business brings him in contact and be ready to pay it without demur, nay, with an appearance of haughty enthusiasm. Otherwise, it will go hard with him. Should he be a poor man, his chances in life are infinitesimal, so long as he is conscientious. No citizen can call his soul his own who dares to openly attack the administrative scoundrelism. Scoundrelism based securely upon purchasable majority votes. Those thievish officials, percolators of Turkey, China, Persia, and Morocco, would hang their heads in utter shame at their own clumsy methods of robbery if they once beheld the magnificent mechanism and finesse wherewith American politicians enrich themselves by bleeding the treasuries, stealing public lands, and sweating the revenues. Indeed, our grand viziers, heaven bless them, not only plunder living generations, but they even make futurity contribute to their hungry rapacity. Their schemes of financial legerdemain are of unparalleled brilliance and grandeur. They borrow thousands of millions upon national credits from the usurers and then proceed to apportion the money unto each other under the elaborate pretense of needful public expenditure, redeeming the currency, etc., etc., in order that the Jew may be secured in his usurious shent per shent, oppressive taxes are laid on the peasantry wherewith to pay the annual interest charge upon the bonded millions. All of these tributes are collectible in appreciating gold at the point of the Supreme Court's bayonet. However, military assistance is very seldom needed to enforce the tax collectors' demands because most Americans are exceptionally docile and good. No need of coercion with a palsied people ever eager to obey the slightest nod of their masters. America, America, never shall you realize the true meaning of thoroughgoing independence and self-proprietorship until an American Cromwell or an American Caesar has signed the death warrant of an American king. The executive that sells his people into bondage is a public enemy, whether he be an elective monarch or an hereditary king. Such a scoundrel and traitor has no rights that property-holding freemen are bound to respect. No, not one. By accepting the gold of public plunderers, he makes himself an Ishmaelite. His hand is against every man's hearth and every man's property. Therefore, every man's hand should be uplifted against him. In days not long gone by, men of our race have hung bribe-takers with secret ceremony and even rolled the heads of kings into the executioner's basket. If we are not now to be robbed of everything we possess and reduced to conditions of absolute state servitude, we must not shrink from doing so again. Despotism, if it is to be overthrown, must be fought with its own weapons, and the vilest of despotisms are ever founded upon majority votes. As for the common people, they are energetically chasing shadowy paternalisms and allowing their substance to be appropriated on a gigantic scale. They are living in a fool's paradise of progress and peaceful industrial evolution, as the cat phrases go. Some of these days they may possibly wake up when too late and discover with alarm and astonishment that all their mock iambics have been of no avail against the insidious growth of centralized oligarchic Hebraism, ballot box desolation, and industrial imperialism. Americans have yet to learn that each generation must fight out its own good fight and not rely for the preservation of its hardihood and independence upon moth-eaten parchments nor on fraudulent statesmen now in the graveyard. Statesmen who spent their petty babblesome lives not in doing heroic things, but in founding and enthroning the abominations that afflict us all today like a palsy. Our national hero worship badly wants reconstruction. 5. Many years after the Declaration was issued, our written Constitution was constructed with much voluble sophistry and mimic strife. That document, considered as a whole, is the most cunningly worded and at the same time most terrible instrument of government and mastership that any Anglo-Teutonic tribe has ever yoked itself up under. Pretending to grant liberty and self-government, it practically annihilates both. Under the show of guaranteeing personal independence and civil rights, it has organized an elective tyranny wherein the mob monarch possesses more arbitrary authority than any dynastic despot since the days of Darius or Belshazzar. The highest crime is actually written in the highest law of the land. Thus did the great guile masters their toils and their tangles set, and as wide as was the water, so wide was woven the net. Indeed, the written constitution of our republic is a monstrous mechanical contrivance that bids fair, when once it has got properly underway, to squeeze the very heart out of all the best elements in America. Our federal government may be very appropriately compared to a pirate ship cleverly disguised as a friendly armed cruiser, convoying a fleet of peaceful merchantmen loaded with an immense treasure and 70 million passengers. When it first came to their assistance, it was, oh, so kindly, so affectionate, so full of loving regard for its intended prey, for the welfare and bon voyage of its quarry. Now, however, that its 45 ships of state are out in the open ocean and absolutely at its mercy, it strips off its decoy rig, hoists the death's head in bloody bones, opens its hidden portholes, runs out its round-lipped broadsides, and yells through the editorial speaking trumpets, "Heave to there, or you'll be blown out of the water." Thus it will be seen the Jesuitic evangel of equality has proved itself a tremendous success. It seduced the American people into a feeling of contentment and security till their bonds and fetters were properly forged, polished, and neatly riveted on. Well fashioned indeed was the net, a splendid spider web it has proved itself, and withal needful. Under the hypnotic spell of a free and equal dream, Americans have been hustled into a convict prison of laboriousness to piratical masters 1,000 times more terrible and more unyielding than any history can describe. All that is now left of liberty is its name and the harmless privilege. All that is now left of liberty is its name and the harmless privilege the common people have of scolding the proprietors in vulgar editorial diatribes at or about election times. Occasionally they do descend into the streets, indulging in sanguinary vociferations upon the same general principle that impels a mangy cur to howl most dismally, if struck with a brick. The conflict between the masters and the helots is over for the present, and the masters, having conquered, are in possession of the booty and the field. Ha! The songs of victory, the flap of the battle pennons. Indeed, considering all the circumstances, the common people are lost souls. No matter what they now do, they must remain in hell. The position is that of a worm trying to escape from its hole in a heated, burning log. If it runs to the right, it runs into heat and smoke, and if it runs to the left, it runs into blazes. A few minutes more and it is roasted alive. Even should America's servile multitudes appeal to the arbitrament of physical force, they cannot possibly win. Possessing neither the strength, courage, brains, arms, money, nor leaders, they must be blown into eternal fragments by their masters' highly trained artillerists and scientific destroyers. 6. The citadel of power is now consolidated and prepared with the most improved armaments to repel any assault, no matter how well sustained. The nation is intersected in all directions with iron high roads and splendid waterways, whereon armies and navies may be moved from city to city with facility and dread effect. The war of secession, or rather the war for the annihilation of self-government, demonstrated conclusively that a centralized authority resting on herd votes of the vulgar and fanatic is, in practice, military absolutism. There is no other power in the land that can effectively hold it in check. The Tsar of Russia possesses less actual authority than our federal government. With a standing army in the hollow of its hands, it can do exactly as it pleases. An example, if it can collect enough revenue to purchase statesmen and pay the salaries of its Praetorian cohorts. Most Americans are only now beginning to perceive these things, but they were foreseen and also foretold in part by clear-sighted individuals before the Constitution itself was formally enthroned. Today, all the old Sphinx questions are up again for solution. No man of balanced sense can honestly believe that these problems are to be settled by ballot box stuffing or editorialism. Settled they must be upon the good old rule, the simple plan, and thereafter settled and resettled again and again. For there is no finality in social adjustments, and there should not be. Material strength is the basis of all human greatness, and material strength must settle the tyranny of the greatest number, probably with fire and steel. All other theories are chimeras, lies, delusions, make-believe, and of no account. The philosophy of power has slumbered long, but whenever men of sterling worth are found, it must again sweep away the ignoble dollar-damned peddlerisms of today and openly, as of old, dominate the destiny of an emancipated and all-conquering race. What is viler than a government of slaves and usurious Jews? What is grander than a government of the noblest and the best, who have proved their fitness on the plains of death? Cromwell and his Ironsides, Caesar and his legions shall be born again, and the thunderous tread of Sulla's fierce destroyers shall roll and rumble amid the fire and glare and smoke of crumbling constitutionalisms, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, warfare without end. Yapping politicians may harangue base city mobs of hirelings and Christlings with, alas, poor Yorick, rhapsody as if struggle and strife with the evil of all evils. Figures of speech, however, cannot breathe the breath of life into feline philosophies that never have had the slightest foundation in fact. The survival of the fittest, the toughest, is the logic of events and of all time. They who declare otherwise are blind. The chief point is this, that fitness must honestly demonstrate itself not by ignoble theft in theory, but by open conflict as per Darwin's law of battle. How can citizens be honestly described as free and equal who are not, who never were, free and equal in any reasonable sense of the phrase? How can they be even considered men whose whole lives are governed by cast iron regulations, whose every movement is circumscribed and restrained by penal threats, even whose secret thoughts are in a constant state of silent repression? It is no apology whatever to affirm that the people themselves enact all laws they are commanded to obey. Even that statement is a falsity, and if it were true, it would not justify majority dictatorship or any other kind of dictatorship. The Constitution under which all other laws are born was accepted not by us, but by bewigged individuals who are long since rotten. We are ruled, in fact, by cadavers, the inhabitants of tombs. Why should agreements made by coffin dead men bind and mortgage living, pulsing, breathing beings? The Constitution, under which all other laws are born, was accepted not by us, but by bewigged individuals who are long since rotten. We are ruled, in fact, by cadavers, the inhabitants of tombs. Why should agreements made by coffin-dead men bind and mortgage living, pulsing, breathing beings? Their bones have long ago molded into ozone and fertilizers. Who drew up and signed the Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, the Sermon on the Mount, the Declaration of Independence, our glorious Constitution, etc., etc. Rotten are the brains that concocted them and the fingers that signed and sealed them. Equally rotten are their irrational and infantile philosophies. Rotten also in their heart are the men who obey, under compulsion, voices from the tomb. No doubt those old documents served their purpose at the time, but new occasions teach new duties, and new ages require not only new leaders, but new deeds. Again, most acts of Congress are the Machiavellian work of eminent rogues. Curse them whose very names are almost forgotten except by partisan chroniclers and princes of public school histories. As for the common law, it is an inheritance from those interesting old days when Saxon and Norman earls, they were genuine noblemen then, for they had won their position by risking their lives in battle, administered justice direct, per media of knotted clubs, halted knives, and long-handled cleavers. That was the only kind of law understood by our uncivilized forefathers, for they had not been educated into the profound convictions that governments and laws derive all their just powers from the consent of the governed. Such an expression would have sent them into convulsions, and he who uttered it would be considered a most excellent fool. No doubt our ancestors were somewhat rude in their manners, somewhat deficient in sweetness and culture, but in matters of frozen fact they were decidedly logical. They did not sneak to public meetings and swagger about liberty, justice, and equality of opportunity, or rights of man when they knew full well that not only their lives, but everything they nominally possessed was by leave of their conquerors and proprietors. They accepted their position pro tem, and when again ready, honestly re-entered the doom ring to test anew their fate. If they could come alive again, how those old pirates and freebooters would stare in shame and scorn at the sight of their tenderfoot posterity, walking up in solemn, horny-handed, hump-backed procession in shoddy rags before an idol altar called a ballot box, dropping into its gilded maw, printed invocations for justice, mercy, liberty, peace in our time, O Lord, protection, cheap money, more laws, more laws, more laws. How our blonde, clean-limbed ancestors would guffaw. Indeed, they would probably keep on guffawing till they guffawed themselves to death again. Oh, they would say, to think that our seed should have sunk so low. 7. But equality before the law is all we mean, whimpers the everlasting sophist, the cunning liar. Let us see. By what rational method can any two litigants be placed in a position of unconditional equality before the law? First of all, plaintiff and defendant always possess totally different physical and mental characteristics, different personal magnetisms, and different sized bank balances. Also, all judges, juries, and legal officials are unequals in temperament, ability, courage, and honesty. Each one has his own peculiar idiosyncrasies, prejudices, inferiorities, superstitions, and price. Each, again, may be more or less dishonest and more or less subject to financial pressure or caste bias. No two men are born alike, each one being literally born under his own particular star, formed of different material, swayed by different ideals, educated and molded in a different mill by a different process. Even if all tribunals of justice were founded upon blind impartiality and administered free of cost, it would be plainly seen that equality before the law remains a mere chimera, a dream, and of no real value. Equality before the law is just a meaningless catchword, something like that famous Jesuitism, liberty regulated by law. Statute law may formally counter equal rights. Statute law may formally confer equal rights and privileges upon unequal citizens, but it cannot enforce itself. It must execute its mandate through human media, and that media is full up to the brim with superiorities, inferiorities, and inequalities. No legalism has ever been devised that strength cannot drive its coach and fore through, and it is a popular proverb in all lands that somehow there is one law for the rich and another for the poor. Indeed, the poor can never be placed upon an equality with the rich, not even by the pillage of the rich. Whether they are the fittest or not, the present proprietors of wealth should never permit themselves to be plundered without a savage struggle. Sooner or later, the hour of this struggle in its acute form shall arrive, but the rich must not dread it. If they prepare in time, the result shall not only justify their mastership, but render it impregnable. If they are fit, to be respected and secure, aristocracies must rest themselves upon sordid might, not upon paper credits, consuls, and bond issues. Should the opulence be conquered and pillaged, that in itself will be conclusive evidence that they are neither the fittest nor the best. Upon this earth there is no such thing as equal justice. All legal tribunals are based not upon ideal concepts of justice and fair play, but upon effective armed strength. This is a truism. Robbery under arms laid the cornerstone of every courthouse in Christendom and elsewhere. How then can the robbers and the robbed, the eagle and the pigeon, the chicken and the hawk be placed in positions of genuine equilibrium before removable officials, specially paid and appointed to vindicate the law? That is to give forcible effect to the dicta of the strongest. All judges are authorized avengers armed to the teeth, and all hangmen are licensed assassins trained to kill. These words are not spoken in disparagement, assassins and avengers, ha, if that be so. Truly they that seek the Lord do suffer hunger, but lions seek for prey. When an army of occupation settles down upon an enemy's territory, it issues certain rules of procedure for the orderly transference of the property and persons of the conquered into the absolute possession and unlimited control of the conquerors. These rules of procedure may at first take shape as orders issued by military generals, but after a time they develop themselves into statute books, precedents, and constitutions. Indeed, all law is now and ever has been the mandate of successful belligerents, or rather the mandate of the few masterful personalities that ever inspire them. Equality before the law is thus a contradiction in terms, for law itself is an incarnation of inequality. It is true only in the subjective sense that all who obey the law are equally the servants of those who make it or cause it to be made. Drumhead court-martials are really law courts in embryo. Congresses and parliaments are merely committees of rapacious tax gatherers. Legislators may describe themselves as representatives of the people, but that is only a cunning masquerade. Their chief vocation is to strengthen the law, uphold the Constitution, vote the annual appropriations, and devise ways and means of exploiting the nation or of permitting it to be systematically looted by their accomplices or their masters. The principles that govern a holdup are the selfsame principles that govern government. No government on earth rests on the consent of the governed. It is reasonable, therefore, for a confederation of masterful bandits to place themselves in positions of absolute equality before their intended victims. The idea is absurd on the face of it. Brigandage necessitates inequality, and every government on earth is organized and enthroned brigandage. Las Casas, the Spanish Jesuit, was the first in America to spread about the false, subversive, and shameful theory of equal human rights. But since his time, it has been boastfully accepted on all sides by vast hordes of witless persons who are in all countries the numerical majority. The race of fools, as Plato sagaciously remarked, is not to be counted, not even in this land of the free. Although equality, in any shape, has never been scientifically proven nor logically defended, nevertheless it passes from tongue to tongue, from brain to brain in current discussions for gospel truth, just as clever counterfeit coins are passed unsuspectingly from hand to hand. The equality superstition is tolerated by clear-seeing men for one reason only. It assists them to govern the thoughts, and by governing the thoughts, to exploit the property, energy, and labor force of all their soft-minded, good-natured neighbors who really believe it to be true, who think it glad tidings of great joy. Behold, when the fraudulent equality of natural rights evangel is mellifluously poured forth in the marketplaces by suave, dollar-hunting attorneys or half-educated mechanics, even those staid citizens, whose life is of it a direct disproof, lead the roaring, raving, yelling crowd in its maniacal bellowings. Lo, the angel of lunacy is camped in their souls. 8. Every atom of organic matter has its own vital peculiarity. Every animate being is different in osseous structure and chemical composition. Ethnology, biology, history, all proclaim equality to be a myth. Even the great ethics of antiquity are all glorifications of inequality. Inequality of mind, inequality of birth, of courage, or condition. Can equality of body, equality of mind, equality of origin, equality before the law, or any other kind of damned equality be demonstrated by any one fact? Mentally and morally, every breathing being is a self-poised monad, a differential ego. No two germs, planets, suns, or stars are alike. Among the higher vertebrates, this is especially so, and consequently, the only law that men ought to honor or respect is the law that originates and finds its final sanction in themselves, in their own consciousness. Inequality is summed up in the scientific axiom, inferior organisms succumb that superior organisms may survive, propagate, and possess. In other words, the proper place for Lazarus is to rot among the dogs. And the proper place for Caesar is at the head of his irresistible legions. From the soles of his feet to the crown of his head, the bone, skin, and flesh of his body, even the gray brain pulp, the electric nerves and tissues, mental ganglia and internal viscera of a man belonging to the African, Mongolian, Semite, or Negro breeds are all fundamentally different in formation, constituents, and character from the corresponding anatomical sections in men of Aryan descent. The points of non-resemblance may be superficially unperceivable, but they are organic, deep-seated. Notwithstanding the dexterous writers of strategic fables, dross is dross, gold is gold, and some men are born better, born nobler, born braver than others. Aristocracy by birth rests upon an unalterable scientific basis of heredity and selection, but an aristocracy of money rests mainly upon bolts and bars. an example upon laws that may be abrogated at a moment's notice. Though unable to reason out in logical sequence their inherent abhorrence of social and racial equality, yet most men instinctively detest it in practice. What white father, for example, would encourage the marriage of a hulking, thick-skulled Negro with his beautiful and accomplished daughter? Would he enthusiastically give her away to the matrimonial embraces of a Chinaman, a coolie, or the leper hugs of a polluted, mean white? Is the 10 such citizens even in North America, where equality of birth and condition is so much speechified and never seen? Is there five? Is there one who would not rather see the daughter of his loins stiff, stock, and cold in her shroud? Should that one exist, he being of sound mind, let him speak. Then and only then can this diabolical gospel of intrinsic equality be reconsidered. Meanwhile, plain, practical citizens are justified in regarding it not as a self-evident truth, but an insolent, malignant, and abominable lie, a lie that shall yet be stamped out forever with blood and fire. You have only to look at some men to know that they belong to an inferior breed. Take the Negro, for example. His narrow cranial development, his prognathous jaw, his projecting lips, his wide nasal aperture, his simian disposition, his want of forethought, originality, and mental capacity are all peculiarities strictly inferior. Similar language may be applied to the Chinaman, the coolie, the Kanaka, the Jew, and to the rotten-bone city degenerates of Anglo-Saxondom, rich and poor. Vile indeed are the inhabitants of those noxious cattle kraals, London, Liverpool, New York, Chicago, New Orleans, and yet in those places is heaped up the golden plunder of the world. Ethnographists of the very highest authority assert that over 10,000 years ago, the black, white, and yellow types of men-animal were as pronounced and as ineffaceable as they are today. The hieroglyphics and records of ancient tombs and monuments, cuneiform inscriptions, antiquarian researches, and the systematic study of prehistoric skulls and skeletons all bear the same uniform testimony. Inequality of birth and condition can never perish off the earth. Never. And why should it? Who can fill the valleys up and lay the mountains low? 9. Even the giddy doctrinaire who so cunningly concocted the Bombasto Furioso fictions of the Declaration could not apparently have believed them himself. Was he not a slave driver, residing among slave drivers, who bought and anchored human cattle for dollars and cents all the days of his life? No doubt for purposes of statecraft and necessary warcraft, he wove his philosophic preamble of strong deceit. Probably also, he was comparatively honest and even sincere, but among the alluring priests of unreason, the most dangerous is the fanatical propagandist. When Jefferson dictated his fatal and untenable abstraction, he was not even original, but plagiarized Zeno the Stoic, Jack Cade, Savonarola, Milton, Plato, John Ball, etc. Zeno said, all men are by nature equal, but carefully refrained from attempting to demonstrate it. Milton defended it in his prose essays. Plato voiced it in his Republic. John Ball preached it in medieval England. Savonarola perished trying to establish it in Florence. Jack Cade, Robespierre, and Christ were also failures. Ghastly failures. If human experience proves anything at all, writes James Fitzjames Stevens, it proves that if the restraints are minimized, if the largest possible measure of liberty is accorded to all human beings, the result will not be equality, but inequality, reproducing itself in a geometrical ratio. Remove the restraints and see how quickly an aristocracy based on merit would mow down an aristocracy based on credit. In actual life, he who claims equality with another is ever called upon to prove his claim, not by a grotesque abracadabra of silly phrases, parroted from antique philosophers or blue moldy documents, but by actual deeds. That is to say, by producing his credentials. Constitutional theories are all very well to humbug, stridulating slaves, but in a free man's household or business, they are not legal tender. Among men of affairs, natural egalitarianism is regarded as amusing moonshine, mere spread egoism fit for public meetings only. Business minds thoroughly understand, having learnt by bitter experience, that some men are destined by nature to bear command and some to obey, aye, even for 1,000 years before their birth. No one can study the laborers on a farm, the hands in a big foundry or factory, the seamen in a large seaport, the nomadic hirelings on a railroad construction gang, or the clerks and salesmen in a city warehouse without perceiving at a glance that the vast majority of them are extremely poor specimens of humanity. The ideal type of manhood or womanhood, that is to say, ye thoroughbred, is not to be found among these captive hordes, for captives they really are. Their heads are to a large extent unsymmetrical, their features distorted, ape-like, unintelligent. Their bodies are out of all proportion, dwarfed, stunted, diseased, malformed, cretinous. Their movements are contracted, artificial, ungainly, and their minds, outside of routine, are utter vacuums. When compared with the traditional idea of strength, beauty, courage, and nobleness of character, they are an extremely ill-bred herd of cattle, exhibiting all the psychological stigmata of inherited rain rot and of physical decay. A crown of thorns on every brow, that is the wage they're earning now. 9/10 of them are positively repulsive in language, mentality, and in general appearance. They even display an extraordinary low average of animality, and upon the slightest exposure perish off, like sheep that have the lungworm. Heated rooms, woolen clothing, and stimulating beverages are the means whereby their watery blood is kept in languid circulation. Every new generation is feebler and more debased than its predecessor. All the scientific evidences of mental, moral, and bodily deterioration are markedly accentuated in them. Their timidity is proverbial. Hard, continuous, methodical labor destroys courage, saps vitality, and demoralizes character. It tames and subdues men, just as it tames and subdues the wild steer or the young colt. Men who labor hard and continuously have no power to think.
Well, this section of Might is Right, the audio book version, I got a little disjointed here because we don't have them set up exactly in order of their appearance, which we're going to do and put this on the website because this is the most important thing going. This is an expansion of the Might is Right book that I've read out of, but the book I read out of is a little bit more difficult to read. And this audio book, whoever did this, maybe I'll find out, did a hell of a job. And this is really, as far as I'm concerned, all we need. And it shows us how pitiful all our attempts to wake up these idiots and sheep is. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you know. So anyhow, this is Friday. I'll be back Monday. And we're going to get more and more into this kind of stuff and separate ourselves more and more from the herd. There's no other way. I continue to see how a lot of things I do are a total waste of time based on this stuff, you know. So we have to hone our weapons and sharpen them up and cut away all the bullshit, if you get what I mean. 14-5.